Additionally, the study warns the high damage scenario would see 37 million more people likely to become malnourished over the coming decade, including 4 million children under the age of 5, and also that secondary school graduation rates could plummet to 64% worldwide if urgent actions are not taken. We have an opportunity, said Steiner, to invest in a decade of action that not only helps people to recover from COVID-19, but that resets the development path of people and planet towards a more fair, resilient, and green future.
Just a few months ago, the Israeli regime was celebrating the normalization of ties with several Arab nations, including the Persian Gulf states of the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. But could this be the end of the extended arm of friendship, as hope of ties with the Saudi regime could be off before they're on, following the regional security conference in Bahrain? The possible change of plan comes following a speech at the conference by the former Saudi intelligence chief, Turki al-Faisal, who has used the occasion to publicly make a stand against the Israeli regime, potentially reflecting the thoughts of many other senior Saudi royals in Riyadh. The former minister went on to state that the Israeli regime treatment of the people of Palestine was unacceptable, compared them to concentration camps, and noted that the Israeli regime did not discriminate when it came to the treatment of men, women and children, with whom it used brutal measures. However, the Israeli regime, although very red-faced at the accusations from a senior representative of a nation that they'd like to get closer to, were quick to return the remarks, with Israeli Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi stating that the Saudi remarks did not reflect the spirit of the changing region. But it seems that the ties between the Saudi and Israeli regimes are not quite as they seem, with suggestions that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, having met the Saudi Crown Prince Ben Salman in a secret meeting, was nothing more than a lie according to Al-Faisal, suggesting that not all is rosy between the two. So what sparked the remarks by Al-Faisal, and why did he choose the Bahrain summit to embarrass the Israeli regime? As we know, Tel Aviv is guilty of a whole host of sins against the Palestinians, as well as against other nations in the region. So is Turki al-Faisal actually doing nothing more than speaking the truth when it comes to Israeli crimes?
It's very clear and true, and everybody, even those who support Israel, know it's true. The Gaza area is a huge concentration zone where Israel controls the calories that reach Palestinians, kills large numbers of them from time to time, and kills small numbers each day. So yes, a concentration zone, and it can't be seen as anything else. Palestinians are the most imprisoned people on earth, and Israel has a policy where their soldiers can kill Palestinians of any age, from 13 upwards, without fear of any consequences. So yes, it's a killing zone where Arabs can be killed by Jews without any comeback.
It seems that while still under the wing of the outgoing president of the United States of America, the Israeli regime appears to be content in the continuation of the status quo it finds itself in, namely, the blatant disregard for the people of Palestine and for international law. In spite of the United Nations passing Security Council Resolution 2334, stating that the destruction of Palestinian homes to make way for Israeli settlements on the West Bank was illegal, the regime still continues to destroy homes and lives, forcing the people of Palestine into tighter corners as the world simply stands by and watches. Murder and war crimes are also a regular pastime for the Israeli regime, with the recent killing of a Palestinian teenager being one of many examples, which also include Israeli soldiers being praised for killing unarmed Palestinian people, as well as the involvement of the Israeli regime in the assassinations of people abroad. Human Rights Watch, the charity observing events across the globe, have also condemned the Israeli regime for the arbitrary arrests of Palestinians, as well as making allegations of torture and mistreatment of Palestinian people by the regime a common factor in a way that the Israeli forces deal with people once in their custody, something that's once again a clear violation of international law. So maybe then Turki Al-Faisal had a clear and valid point when he said what he did. The evidence is clear for all to see, after all. Could this then raise a speculation as to the benefits of the regimes normalising ties with each other?
Saudi Arabia has famously tried to normalise ties with Israel for a very long time, before 2000, but I think it was 2001, the Arab Peace Initiative, formulated by Saudi Arabia, was rebuffed by Israel. And every approach by Saudi Arabia to normalise relations has been similarly rebuffed. So now it's quite clear the Israelis want normalisation, diplomatic recognition, and nothing in return, nothing for the Palestinians. And it's going to be very dangerous for any regime which recognises Israel, opens up their diplomatic relations, because there's a small thing like the news programmes, and they will continue to show Arabs being killed by the Israeli military because they are Arabs. There will be permanent difficulty for the Saudi regime, once it normalises, to justify that to its own population. That's, I think, what Turki Al-Faisal is rightly afraid of.
There does, however, remain one very real possibility, namely that the allegations raised by Al-Faisal are nothing more than a smokescreen to divert attention away from the secret relationship both Israel and Saudi crave, especially as a bond between the two would strengthen their mutual interest in resisting the Islamic Republic of Iran, and is something that the US would happily agree upon, adding their finger into the pie.
War, famine, and disease. These are just a few crises Yemen has been dealing with in over 5 years since the Saudi-led war broke out in the Arab country, aimed at bringing the government of former President Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. In the meantime, the United States is reportedly considering designating Ansarullah, which has been resisting the Saudi-led aggression, as a terrorist group. Oman's Foreign Minister Sayed Badr al-Busaidi said the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State mentioned the possibility during a visit to Muscat. The development came a day after the United Nations and international aid agencies warned Washington against the plan, citing concerns that the move would prevent life-saving aid from reaching the war-wracked country and would derail a related $700 million relief program.
Well, the major problem, of course, aside from the fact that the designation is completely, you know, uncalled for, it's unfair and unjust, for the basic reason that Ansarullah is not engaged in any terrorist attacks whatsoever and cannot in any way, shape or form be considered a terrorist organization. They have never instigated an unprovoked attack against civilian targets in any country, neither in Yemen itself nor in nations abroad. And even the attacks on Saudi territory that they are being blamed for are legitimate military retaliations against a conflict that has been enforced upon them by Saudi Arabia.
David Beasley, executive director of the UN's World Food Program, told the Washington Post Daily newspaper earlier this week that a designation could hamper aid deliveries. Beasley's warning came following his meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he expressed grave concerns about the blacklisting of Ansarullah. Last week, dozens of arms control and human rights organizations denounced a U.S. plan to sell multi-billion dollars worth of arms to the United Arab Emirates. In a letter to the U.S. Senate Department and Congress, 29 advocacy groups warned that arming the UAE would cause more humanitarian crises, as the country is a party to the conflicts in Yemen and Libya. The groups added that U.S. President Donald Trump's possible designation of Yemen's Ansarullah as a terrorist group can have catastrophic impacts on the world's largest humanitarian crises and response, while also hampering UN-led efforts to secure a ceasefire and start peace talks. UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffith, who has been mediating between the warring sides, called last month for all parties to the conflict to take final decisions required to implement a pact that aims to bring a nationwide ceasefire, specific measures to improve the lives of Yemenis, and the resumption of the political process to reach a lasting peace.
This is not necessarily an issue of who you support and who you oppose. This is not necessarily an issue of supporting Ansar Allah, supporting the revolution of September 21 of 2014. They're not necessarily a support to the National Salvation Government or to the organization that is called the Houthis, Ansar Allah. You don't have to support them in order to agree that the United Nations peace negotiations are probably the only way to stop this conflict without either party having to be completely defeated in the field. If you want to stop the conflict and prevent further bloodshed and prevent the drawing out of this war for years to come, then you need to negotiate.
The ongoing conflict in Yemen shows no sign of abating, with more civilians being killed and displaced every day. In the meantime, the United States' moves on Yemen have not only damaged the horizons for peace, but also hamper efforts to provide much-needed aid to millions of people.
On Friday, the news agency Reuters published a report on a confidential letter sent by Iran to the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran. The letter contained information on Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. The leak prompted an angry reaction from Iran and other countries. Iran condemned the IAEA and criticized the leak. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that the agency is responsible for the incident and that the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. He said that Iran will shortly take legal action over the leak of information. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal.
All safeguards and JCPOA reports, as well as Iran's correspondence with the IAEA and vice versa, are confidential. The IAEA shares its reports in its internal site, only accessible to its member states.
Gharibabadi said that Tehran has already asked the agency to minimize the amount of details it gives its member states in its reports and to avoid providing them with non-essential information. He said the history of Iran's legal protests against the IAEA over its failure to preserve confidential information dates back more than two decades.
In 2018, the Washington Post reported that Israeli intelligence agencies and experts have gotten a hold, actually, of sensitive information of Iran's nuclear capability through the IAEA. And this is no accident, given that the IAEA is heavily biased towards Israel. So it's natural that the spies involved have had institutional leverage as well with officials that were working with the IAEA and using it as an opportunity to extract information about Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Indeed, the incident is the latest in a series of tensions between Iran and the IAEA over the matter. This is not the first time that confidential information on Iran is leaked by the Atomic Agency. Over the years, and even before signing the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, confidential information related to Iran has been leaked to non-parties to the JCPOA on many occasions. After signing the deal, Iran witnessed leakage of its confidential reports and information by the UN nuclear watchdog numerous times. With the ongoing tension between Iran and the UN nuclear agency, it may be safe to say that the trust between Iran and the IAEA is at its lowest level. Observers say that the IAEA-Iran cooperation problems and lack of trust between them comes from a series of issues. The main reason can be that the UN nuclear watchdog's unprofessional behavior in conducting inspections in Iran. Tehran says on numerous occasions the agency's request was based on unfounded documents or baseless allegations. There were also incidents that fueled the distrust. One of the most significant cases was an IAEA inspector who tried to contaminate the Iranian nuclear facilities with nuclear materials of an unknown origin. Another case was the explosion that occurred at the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran says the only official party that has the details of the activities at Natanz was the IAEA. Observers say incidents like these are the source of distrust between Iran and the agency. No wonder Iran hesitates to allow certain inspections on its nuclear facilities. There are also serious allegations that indicate IAEA's mismanagement to protect Tehran's confidential information, which has led to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the years. U.S. political influence on the IAEA is another reason. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Experts say now the U.S. is trying to turn the nuclear agency into part of their pressure campaign. They say the U.S. has always exploited international institutions to implement their policies against certain countries when they fail to directly pressure those countries.
There's no doubt about it. The IAEA is serving as a direct intelligence arm between Israel, the European Union, and the United States as an agency that has consistently demonstrated its bias and preferential treatment in favor of Israel, who have consistently used the agency to lobby for harsher aggression and action against Iran, in favor, obviously, of Israel, who at the same time is not a signatory on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and has weapons stockpiles, nuclear stockpiles of its own that it does not allow any inspection of by international agencies.
Iran has always expressed readiness to further cooperate with the IAEA in a bid to reach an understanding on the unresolved issues. It also announced that it had full cooperation with the UN nuclear agency. However, the recent incident shows that the IAEA once again has failed to build trust with Iran, which raises the question as to why Tehran should continue trusting the agency with its confidential information.
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centres finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the decision by the British to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits, with the UK having the worst rates in Europe, with already 60,000 people dead from the virus. The US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing President of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words. What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail? And as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US, for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves the vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, there are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members? But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
The Trump administration is quietly launching a last-minute assault on Social Security by rushing ahead with a rule that, if implemented, could deny critical benefits to hundreds of thousands of American people with disabilities. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump launches despicable last-minute attack on Social Security with rule aiming to restrict disability benefits. Here's the details of this article. Just weeks away from relinquishing power to Joe Biden, the Trump administration is quietly launching a last-minute assault on Social Security by rushing ahead with a rule that, if implemented, could deny critical benefits to hundreds of thousands of people with disabilities. The Social Security Administration, SSA, late last week submitted to the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, a proposed rule aiming to further tighten eligibility requirements for Social Security disability benefits, which around 10 million Americans currently rely on for a modest monthly income. While it is unclear whether the rule can be finalized before Biden takes office next month, Social Security defenders reacted with outrage to the proposal and called on the president-elect to make clear that he will immediately roll back the change. It is outrageous. Richard Fiesta, executive director of the Alliance for Retired Americans, said in a statement on Monday, December 7th, the Trump administration could pull the rug out from millions of Americans, especially older Americans, in the waning days of its administration. Since the day he took office, President Trump has claimed he would protect Social Security. He is showing his true colors again. Advocacy groups, Social Security Works, called the proposal a despicable attack on people with disabilities or on Social Security system, and urged Biden, whose own record on Social Security has been heavily criticized by progressives, to clean house at the Social Security Administration on day one by replacing top officials appointed by President Donald Trump. In the works for months, the Trump administration's proposed rule would significantly revise the criteria by which SSA determines who does and doesn't qualify for disability benefits. Under current law, applicants with certain serious conditions automatically qualify for benefits. Those with other ailments are deemed qualified or not based on an evaluation of additional factors such as age, work history, education, and residual functional capacity. The Trump administration's proposed rule, as the Wall Street Journal reported earlier this year, would no longer assume age seriously affects a person's ability to adapt to simple entry-level work. It would raise the age at which education and work experience are considered in determining eligibility to 55 from 50, the journal reported. The new rule would also update data on occupational skills that the agency uses to determine eligibility based on new information from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Another component of the proposed overhaul, according to HuffPost, would essentially redefine full-time work at 30 hours per week instead of the usual 40 for purposes of determining whether someone is disabled. Fewer people would likely win benefits as a result, HuffPost noted. Fiesta warned that the Trump administration's rule, one of many attacks it has launched on Social Security during its 4 years in power, would impose a massive change that could push thousands of Americans into poverty. Social Security's disability payments are modest, an average of $15,096 each year for the average worker, said Fiesta. These benefits are not easy to receive. Disabled workers go through a lengthy and rigorous process to determine eligibility. We are in a pandemic that is hitting older Americans the hardest. Our government should be helping Americans who can no longer work due to disability, not scheming to deny them the benefits they have earned over a lifetime of work, he said. Economist David Weaver joined calls for Biden to immediately roll back the Trump administration's proposed change, noting in an op-ed for The Hill on Monday, December 7th, that the rule could ultimately prevent as many as 500,000 Americans from receiving benefits. Looking at the recent or modern data, the current system routinely denies benefits to older individuals with serious health problems and diminished prospects in the modern economy, Weaver wrote. Amplifying these outcomes by trying to get even more denials is not a rational policy approach. Bethany Lilly, director of Income Policy Advocacy Group, the ARC, told HuffPost that if a rule hasn't been finalized by the time the Biden administration takes office, they can effectively just put a stop to it.
European News Bulletin. From London, hello everyone. My name is Saeed Forza. Our top story this hour. With time running out for a trade deal with the EU before December 31st, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is holding crunch talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen over dinner in Brussels to try and break the impasse in negotiations. The two leaders are expected to discuss the major sticking points, including fishing rights, state aid, and dispute resolution. The meeting comes a day after EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier warned chances of a deal were very slim. Wading into the Brexit squabble, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey has warned that failure to secure a deal would leave more lasting scars on the British economy than the coronavirus pandemic. Let's speak about that with Jonathan Fryer. He is an author and political commentator joining me now. Good to have you with us. Let me begin by asking you the question that's on everybody's mind. Is a deal still possible? Boris Johnson, the UK Prime Minister, seems to suggest that there is a good deal out there to be made.
Well, things are absolutely on a knife edge at the moment. As you mentioned, Boris Johnson is going to have a dinner meeting with Ursula von der Leyen this evening, and therefore there are signs that a deal is possible, but it's not particularly likely at the moment, unfortunately. And in fact, in the House of Commons earlier today, the Prime Minister was really quite belligerent in his stance, saying that there was no way he was going to allow Britain to be effectively pushed around by the EU and to be made to follow EU rules now that we are outside the European Union. So it's on a knife edge, but it's not looking particularly good at the moment.
It sure doesn't. We've also heard the German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying they are ready for a no deal as well. Let's also talk about the UK economy, if we may. The government here says they're ready to crash out without a deal. The Bank of England governor, as I just read, begs to differ. Who are Britons to believe, really?
Well, I think in this particular case, they should be listening to the governor of the Bank of England, because what will happen with a so-called no-deal crash out on 1st of January would be that we then move on to trading on WTO terms, which means the slapping of tariffs on all sorts of goods in both directions to and from Britain and the European Union. And some of those tariffs are extremely high, which would make some of the British produce commercially unviable and indeed would disrupt cross-channel trade appallingly. So it's a very bleak prospect indeed if that's what we end up with.
And after this dinner this evening between Johnson and von der Leyen, Boris Johnson is speaking for the UK. What about Ursula von der Leyen? Will she have to take the result of this meeting to the 27-member bloc, the heads of state, and tell them what the outcome has been, and then for them to make this a decision on that?
She will indeed. I mean, she has taken over from Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, to underline the importance and the urgency of the situation. There is a council meeting of the leaders of the EU27 tomorrow in Brussels, running into Friday, and that's really the last chance for this to go ahead. So what she says, what she tells them tomorrow is are absolutely vital. But it's not just Germany that's preparing for a no deal. Ireland has been doing so for several weeks already, and certainly the mood music in Brussels amongst the EU27 is pretty gloomy tonight.
All right, Jonathan Fryer, thank you very much. Now, UK regulators have warned people with a history of significant allergic reactions against receiving the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for COVID-19. The advice came only hours after two hospital staff members who received the jab on the first day of the UK's mass immunization program suffered an allergic reaction. But both individuals are reportedly recovering after receiving treatment. The UK became the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer vaccine just last week, with care home workers, hospital patients, and National Health Service staff getting the jab ahead of others. On that topic, global organizations say 90% of people in dozens of poor countries will miss out on the COVID-19 vaccine. They say rich nations have already snatched up more than 2 billion doses. That's almost all of the world's current supply. Meanwhile, countries subject to Western sanctions say rich nations are already using their control over supply and demand as a political weapon. Bianca Rahimi has this.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
These countries represent 14% of the global population, but they have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population 5 times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All right, let's talk about that story with Dr. Ranjit Barare. He is an NHS consultant, a physician and surgeon, joining me now. Pleasure to have you with us, as always. We just heard Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, speaking of equitable access to everyone, but his country is top of the list of countries that have been hoarding all these vaccines. In his case, enough to immunize every Canadian 5 times over. Is there a way to ensure that these hoardings won't happen? There's a fair distribution of the vaccines across the world.
Said, fantastic to be back with you. I think this is another classic case of the pandemic holding up a mirror to the globe and showing it as it really is, and the disparity between the words and deeds of the very richest nations. Our governments, you know, the plutocracy in the City of London, may talk about human rights normally as cover for a bombing campaign to steal the resources of another country. I'm afraid when push comes to shove, you see the same distribution in terms of energy resources. And really, we have to worry whether these are in fact the best vaccines. I think the fact that the vaccine of Pfizer-BioNTech can only be stored at minus 70 degrees C, the fact that it's so expensive means that it won't be the vaccine that will answer the global problems. And I think it's increasingly likely that the countries across the world will instead look to those more stable and cheaper vaccines offered on a preferential rate, as Xi Jinping said, as a global human good from China and Russia.
Not only that, we have to take two doses of it, too, 21 days apart. The global rollout is also being hampered by countries in the West using this as yet another political tool. Your reaction?
I think if you look at the global rollout, the fact is that really the only published data for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is a first interim analysis covering only a minority of their 44,000 patients enrolled in their trial. It's a large trial, but it's a tiny number of patients relative to the number who are now going to be injected. So 40 million doses have come to the UK, 800,000 already are being rolled out. I'm likely to be one of the people offered that. The elderly and the NHS are the first people in line. But actually, you know, there won't be enough doses. Even 1.2 billion doses is only enough for 600 million people, a small proportion of the world. But in fact, Said, I think the point to come to again and again is that this won't be the vaccine offered to the vast majority of the peoples of the world. And that's probably for the best, because actually those that have been taking it in China, probably a million people, have shown it to have a better efficacy and a better safety profile.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we've also heard of some allergic reactions being experienced by a few who have taken it. Will this raise any further questions about how quickly this vaccine was approved for use?
I think it has done, and you can see that MHRA are trying to do a damage limitation exercise. It is the case, okay, that we will see allergies with almost any medication. Penicillin is very common allergies, but we still use it. So I think probably it's still the case that the benefit outweighs the good, but it's hard to fully assess that when, as I say, and I hate to stress the point again and again, we're talking about a first interim analysis, not a lot of data. And really, I'm willing to participate. I will take the vaccine. We don't have a choice as to which vaccine we have. But it is really a larger stage in a phased trial. And more information will come out about the safety profile over the coming days and weeks, Said.
Dr. Ranjit Brar, an NHS consultant, physician and surgeon. Thank you.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Let's see what's been trending in the social media world. Story one, a recent report by the Casa War Project at Brown University in the U.S. state of Rhode Island claiming the number of Afghan civilians killed in U.S.-led airstrikes has increased by 330% since a 2017 decision by the Trump administration to relax the rules of engagement for airstrikes against the Taliban. More now with Robert and Lakesh. And Robert, the U.S. military has refuted this report as one-sided. Tell us why we shouldn't believe them.
Well, what we can see by looking at the statistics and the raw data that we've been presented with is that just last year alone, 900 civilians only in Afghanistan were killed as a result of these airstrikes. If you're going to talk about one-sided, we could discuss the U.S. media and how it discusses the war in Afghanistan, which has gone on for 19 years. There's no objective there. It's an unwinnable war. Why are they there? And they get angry when Trump even talks about pulling out troops. But what the real sticking point is here is that we saw under Obama, Obama was known as the sort of drone king because he upped drone strikes by tenfold from what George Bush had done in his days. And of course, George Bush is known by many as a war criminal, and that's what he represents to a large portion of the world. But Obama upped that. From this as well, now we've got a 330% increase last year. Again, 700 civilians just in Afghanistan, just that we know about, having been killed just in airstrikes. And these drone strikes, we know, kill overwhelmingly civilians. And they've used these drone strikes as a means of trying to force and coerce the Taliban into discussions. And I mean, if we're talking about terrorist forces inside of the Middle East, they discuss the Taliban all the time. But then, according to this report, we know that most of the political violence has been initiated by the United States itself.
Well, let's hear some online reaction to this story, Robert.
The first one we have here says it's okay, Biden will go back to doing all the things Obama did that you got mad about Trump doing. Drone strikes, kids in cages, bailouts, etc. The media won't mention it, and we'll see postless VP appearances on nightly comedy shows. All will be perfect. You can go back to sleep. And we've got another one here as well saying Trump's escalation of drone strikes in Afghanistan, Middle East, and Africa really puts the lie to his being called an isolationist anti-war president.
Let's move on, Robert, to your second story quickly. The UAE importing goods produced in illegal Israeli settlements. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this development has indicated to us all and really confirmed that the UAE so-called peace deal, as it was announced, is nothing to do with peace. It's about weapons deals to the United Arab Emirates. It's about the United Arab Emirates and Israel and the United States as well coming closer together in terms of their military cooperation and their economic cooperation as well. That's another big key part of this. And we're seeing that. Even the United Arab Emirates have gone forward with buying up a large portion of a team based in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, an Israeli team, which in its chants and in one of its songs actually insults the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So, of course, this would make them complicit in the crimes which are being committed and egging on illegal settlements.
And, Robert, how has this story gone down online among Palestinians, Palestinian rights activists?
Well, everyone is outraged, as you'd expect. The first one we've got here says UAE Sheikh Hamad Nayan bought 50% stake in Israel's most fascist football club, Beitar Jerusalem. Beitar is a Zionist settler project and has never fielded an Arab player. Often chants shameful words about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and burying Arabs. And then we've got another one here from an activist, CJ Worldman, who says Israel is fast tracking thousands of new illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, just like the UAE, Bahrain, and the other traitors said wouldn't happen.
Just like they said it wouldn't happen. Robert in Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And now we move on. The UN Refugee Agency says more than 80 million people are displaced across the globe at the moment, people forced in record numbers from their homes by violence, persecution, and the pandemic. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a global ceasefire back in March to help the fight against the pandemic. However, Western-backed violence in Syria, Yemen, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, and Somalia continue to drive the numbers of refugees. Africa's central Sahel region also saw significant new displacements. The pandemic has also hit traditional corridors used by refugees, forcing people to flee in increasingly dangerous circumstances. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has met his Polish counterparts to discuss their common stance on the EU coronavirus recovery fund. Poland and Hungary are currently blocking the 1.8 trillion euro stimulus package in opposition to a clause linking the release of funds to EU rules on democratic reforms, which they say threatens their sovereignty. EU leaders will try to resolve the dispute at a summit starting Thursday. An EU diplomat has been quoted as saying that if the EU receives no signal that Poland and Hungary will drop their vetoes, it will be forced to go ahead without them.
Let's look at two more stories that have been trending on social media. Story one in this segment, U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's nominee for Secretary of Defense, retired General Lloyd Austin, who will become the first black leader of the Pentagon, if confirmed. Richard Sudan joins me now with a quick analysis and the online reaction to that story. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Yes, very interesting story over in the U.S. Now, as you rightly said, Lloyd Austin has been tipped President-elect Joe Biden's latest pick for the cabinet. And in a nutshell, this guy is a highly decorated former Army general. He was active until 2016, and he oversaw and led and commanded military units in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, of course, most people around the world actually view those wars as illegal. So on the one hand, he's being heralded, obviously, for being the first black person to lead the Department of Defense. But here's the interesting thing. Austin actually sits on the board of directors at Raytheon. Now, Raytheon is a multi-billion dollar worth arms manufacturer and lobbyist, which works in Washington, and they essentially lobby for wars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've had a leading hand in causing much death and destruction around the world. And so now you have somebody tipped as the next defense secretary in the United States, essentially has been profiting from a company which has a massive hand in devastating wars in the Middle East and elsewhere. So people are rightly flagging this up, and people are actually making more of the fact of this man's war credentials rather than the fact he'd be the first black person to lead the...
Right, perhaps defense is not the right word for that department, Richard. Let's have a look at the online reaction.
Sure, let's go to Sen Malavi, first of all, who says, Biden's defense secretary pick, Lloyd Austin, has been on the board of directors of arms company Raytheon since 2016. Trump's defense secretary until last month, Mark Esper, was a vice president of Raytheon. This is the true face of capitalism. And anti-imperialist front says, Biden elects Lloyd Austin as secretary of defense. He is a board member of Raytheon, the company which sells bombs to Saudi Arabia to destroy Yemen.
Well, let's move on to your second story, Richard, and how New Zealand security agencies failed to prevent last year's terrorist attack on two mosques in the country.
Right, so New Zealand and the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, are reacting to the findings of an inquiry, which Jacinda Ardern herself said she wanted to figure out if they could prevent the terror attacks of 2019, which left 51 worshippers dead at the hands of Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist. And now the findings of the inquiry basically show that the state's resources, if you like, were focused more on looking at quote-unquote Islamist terror rather than the surging activities of the far right. Now, this is interesting because there seems a disproportionate focus on Muslim communities, but also, you know, there seem to be, you know, there seem to be signs that Brenton Tarrant might be someone to watch. He was known to the system. He was known to authorities. In fact, there's actually a report that he shot himself by accident in the months leading up to the fateful Christchurch shooting. And actually, Tarrant was very easily able to get a firearms license. So, and what's interesting is Ardern has said that the security agencies basically wouldn't do, you know, they wouldn't have been able to stop this this attack, which seems...
I wonder if they would have been able to stop it if he probably had a different name or ethnicity.
Well, I think certainly the hospitals that didn't flag Tarrant shooting himself to the authorities, had he been a brown man, you know, with a foreign name, would they have reacted differently? Many people are speculating. Let's go first.
How people have been reacting to this story.
Absolutely. Let's go to Jeffrey Johnston, who says the Christchurch shooter who murdered 51 people at two mosques was radicalized by far-right messages on YouTube, according to the New Zealand Royal Commission that did the investigation. And the killer also donated to The Rebel and other neo-Nazi outlets online. And we have a reaction from Matteo, who says, New Zealand's security agencies were almost exclusively focused on the threat from Islamist terrorism. The far-right terrorist was treated in a hospital months before the attack after accidentally shooting himself. Medical staff did not report the wounds to the police. A few people have picked up on that aspect of this, Saeed.
I'm sure they have. Richard Sedan. Richard, thanks for all that. And thank you. Stay tuned.
You. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Millions of American people are headed for absolute disaster, one observer said on Monday, December 7th, as Moody's Analytics reported that 12 million renters are expected to owe an average of $5,850 in back rents and utilities after the new year. According to the Washington Post, many American landlords have begun filing paperwork to evict struggling tenants already, and others have joined renters in appealing to Congress for significant unemployment benefits and another round of $1,200 direct payments to Americans. Dear listeners, in this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading Millions of American Tenants Headed for Absolute Disaster After New Year, owing average of nearly $6,000 in rent and utilities. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Without a coronavirus relief package centered on helping U.S. working families who have lost jobs and watched their savings dwindle amid the pandemic, millions of American people are headed for absolute disaster, one observer said on Monday, December 7th, as Moody's Analytics reported that 12 million renters are expected to owe an average of $5,850 in back rent and utilities after the new year. The financial firm reported that $70 billion could be owed to landlords in January after a federal moratorium on evictions put in place in September by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the absence of any action from the Republican-led Senate aimed at helping working people, expires on December 31st.